This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we're going to start with a political discussion because, of course, it's an election season. You probably heard about that. And we're going to talk with Mark Haugen. He is the Democratic NPL candidate for North Dakota Treasurer. He joins us today to talk about his candidacy. Mark, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us about your background and how you believe it fits in with the job of North Dakota State Treasurer.
Thank you. Yes, I'm employed by the University of Mary in Bismarck. I'm a student success advisor in the graduate world with BA students, Masters of Education students. And I've been in education most of my adult life, mostly in technical education through the Emergency Medical Services in North Dakota. I've been teaching EMT paramedic classes as well. About 1987 is when I started in the education world in emergency medical services. I started teaching in Hettinger, North Dakota, and also was a field paramedic, been a field paramedic in Hettinger, in Garrison, in Fargo. Completed my education in Fargo, my paramedic school education. My undergrad degree is at the University of Mary, as well as my graduate degree. But emergency medical services have been mostly part of my life as far as my education background and my adult and my obviously my adult education background. We also at St. Alexis Medical Center, we built a consortium at Bismarck State College so paramedic students could earn a degree while going to school and then going out into our volunteer systems and paid systems throughout North Dakota. This is ambulance services and fire departments. And serving the people of North Dakota. So that's been primarily my background in education. I'm also been in leadership with emergency medical services at the national level with the accreditation of paramedic schools, as well as president of the North Dakota EMS Association, where I have lobbied for EMS back in the 1990s. I currently serve on the board of directors of the North Dakota EMS Foundation. We're raising dollars for equipment and various needs for ambulance service across North Dakota, as well as my wife and I have our philanthropists as well through scholarships that we've been giving to paramedic students since 2000. And currently that scholarship program is housed with the Bismarck State College Foundation, but we're still very active in building that fund for paramedic student scholarships. So philanthropy, education, leadership, In my roles as a chairman, president, treasurer, I feel make me a great fit for the office of state treasurer of North Dakota.
How would you contrast your approach to the job with your opponent? That's going to be Thomas Beadle. He's the Republican candidate.
Well, we have to look at, obviously, some of the issues that have arose over the last several years. I believe that with the first day one, when I come into office, I'm going to build a culture of leadership, integrity, and trust and transparency, which are my hallmarks of my campaign. We also have to look at Century Code. We had an issue with Century Code ambiguity with the state's treasurer's office having to do with that created a $262 million shortfall in three very important constitutionally mandated funds, the Common Schools Trust Fund, the Foundation Aid Stabilization Fund, and the Water Resource Trust Fund. Now, what happened was that at question was the state share of revenue from oil drilling on reservation land. That language was fuzzy in Century Code. Is my understanding that the legislature had the opportunity to address this much sooner than the 2019 session. They should have, but that didn't happen. But on day one, we're going to go through the Century Code and make sure that the duties of the state treasurer and the work that it does, the very transparent distribution of funds throughout North Dakota to all of our municipalities is done in accordance with the Century Code to make sure that so the language of the law, that we are conducting our business in the language of the law for the people of North Dakota.
The previous treasurer, or the current treasurer, is Kelly Schmidt. She's not running for a four-year term in this office. So what you're referring to there was under her administration. But let's talk about the role of the state treasurer. How do you make this a vital decision for voters? Because this isn't the top of the ticket.
Exactly. It's the smallest office in state government, but it plays a very important role. Every dollar in state government transparently flows through the treasurer's office. And that means, first and foremost, it needs to be an office that's independent, accountable to the people of North Dakota. Over the years, we've looked at this issue, whether the state treasurer should be housed underneath the governor's office, primarily in the Office of Management and Budget. And I disagree with that thought. I think the people of North Dakota in two previous election cycles, or two previous elections going back a couple decades ago, decided the office should be elected. The office should be accountable to people and not under the governor's office. So one, it's important that we show transparency and trust and independence accountable to the people of North Dakota. And that's my goal when I come in as treasurer.
Well, how do you campaign in a pandemic?
I've been telling people all over North Dakota, it's been the joy of my life. I've ran for the legislature in 1996, 98, and 2000. So this is my first time in 20 years I've ran for elected office, but this is the first time I've ever ran for statewide elected office. Now I'm having the time of my life. And so thank you for bringing that question up. Basically, we've been very smart about the events that we've been conducting. Most of them, if not all of them, have been outdoors. We've been wearing masks, especially when we cannot social distance. And the people that I've been around that have been attending all of our events, and there have been dozens of events all over North Dakota, we've been very, very good about, staying 6 feet away from each other, wearing masks, and things down, good hygiene when we're conducting maybe a little picnic or a little gathering throughout the state. And parades are fun as well, but parades, you can stay social distance. And so through parades and events and virtual meetings, we've been having a number of virtual events through Zoom or Microsoft Teams, a number of different platforms. But a combination of all three, I think, have helped get my message across.
Mark Haugen is the Democrat NPL candidate for North Dakota Treasurer. You can find out more at HauganForTreasurer.com. And I went up there, Mark, and you refer to your family history with the party because your grandfather was involved in the merger of the Democratic and NPL parties in the late 1940s. And you have been the chairman of the District 32 Democratic NPL Committee. The state of North Dakota, though, has been profoundly Republican for most of its existence. So how do you deal with that formidable obstacle?
Yes, I'm running a campaign that is, although, yes, I am a very proud Democratic NPLer, and that goes back to my childhood days, learning from the stories of my grandfather. And so I've kept that philosophy. I've grown up in Western North Dakota during the farm crisis. I attended school although I'm Caucasian, I attended school in Fort Berthold Indian Reservation at White Shield through eighth grade, and developed a love for the Arikara people. And just the times of the 1960s and 70s developed and formed my thought that, I am a Democrat. I am a Democratic nonpartisan leader, but I have to run an election that we can win. So I'm trying to show my level of independence. For example, I did receive the endorsement of Senator Kevin Cramer's wife, Chris Cramer, recently, that hopefully give me a boost among independents and lean Republicans to say that I'm not just your standard run-of-the-mill Democratic nonpartisan leader. I have a moderate streak to me, and although the reason why she endorsed me is because my wife and I are Roman Catholic. We do believe in the sanctity of life, and that all life at all stages is precious. But that's not part of my campaign, and that's not part of that's not part of the treasurer's office. But I'm trying to lean into that arena so that I can let people know that it's okay that you can vote for a Democratic NPLer that in some areas leans a little to the right on some of these issues. And just knowing that the treasurer's office is not a policy making department, it is an executive office doing the people for North Dakota. But I was very happy to get Chris Cramer's endorsement as well as other endorsements such as the North Dakota AFL-CIO. And North Dakota Right to Life, the North Dakota Association of Realtors. The North Dakota Association of Realtors is not normally known as a left-leaning organization, but they did endorse me as well. So I've had both endorsements on the right and the left.
Your campaign slogan is, I believe, we'll stick, we'll win. Explain that to us.
Well, that goes back to the nonpartisan league days when obviously they were running their most of their candidates, especially in the early years and through the later years, starting in the 1940s, they ran their candidates in the Republican column, and it split the Republican Party many times down the middle, where NPLers were getting elected, as well as Republicans were getting elected up and down the ticket. And so it split the Republican Party right down the middle. And so that was the motto of the nonpartisan league: we'll stick, we'll win. And so it was sticking together. And the Democratic and NPL party took on that motto as well, when you still had NPLers that were wondering whether we're doing the right thing moving over in the Democratic column. So we carried on that motto: we'll stick, we'll win in the end.
Mark Haugen is the Democratic NPL candidate for North Dakota Treasurer. More information about him at HauganForTreasurer.com. There's also a Mark Haugen Facebook page. On your website, you have a blog, so people can kind of follow your ruminations about the campaign. Mark, thanks for spending time with our listeners today.
Thank you very much. It's a joy to be with you.
Coming up on Main Street, the Fargo-Moorhead Studio Art Crawl is going statewide.
In their 21st season of chamber music, the Missouri Valley Chamber Orchestra opens with a trip around Europe. Your tour guide, the MVCO Woodwind Quintet, presents works from five countries in a concert titled European Vacation. From the raucous entry march of the Boyers to the sublime strains of Franz Strauss's Nocturno, performed by French hornist Crystal Jordan, listeners travel through sights and sounds beyond the prairie. Join the quintet in concert at 3 p.m. Sunday, October 4th at the Shepherd of the Valley Lutheran Church south of Wachter Middle School, Bismarck. Tickets are available at the door.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's time to talk about a big event that comes up the first weekend in October every year. It's the FM Studio Crawl, and this year the FM Studio Crawl isn't just around Fargo-Moorhead. Everybody can take part. And joining us to talk about it, Kim Bromley and Jackie Anderson, two very well-known artists in the Fargo-Moorhead area, and I'm sure beyond. Kim, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Jackie, a pleasure to have you with us as well.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, let's start, Jackie, with you. Tell us about the Fargo-Moorhead Visual Artists Organization.
It's a wonderful organization to belong to. Very eclectic. Many, many different kinds of art the artists produce. It isn't just one media. They are from everything from metal to printmaking to painting to jewelry, anything that has related to the arts. And we have to be vetted to get in. We have to have a studio that's open to the public. And it has to be approved by an outsider. So we get in. We pay our dues. We meet annually, the whole group, about the second week in October. Other than that, we just have scattered official shows and meetings that artists can enter and hang their pieces. It's a really nice organization.
Jackie Anderson has been doing this for like 50 plus years. You've been painting and teaching and
thank you.
Getting involved.
Well, you know, I told some people last year that I was probably the oldest artist on the tour because I've reached the age of 81 and I'm still producing art. Isn't it sad? It's just in my blood since about 7 years old. My dad encouraged me no end, and I've had good mentors and teachers and enthusiasms that I've had good students when I was teaching in the Fargo schools also.
I did a little research, Jackie. You started working for Bell Telephone as an illustrator back when you were about like 18, right?
Yes, 18, and worked with printing the yellow pages and stuff. And then I went to an advertising agency for a couple of years. And then I started college at 26 because I always wanted to be an art teacher. And I achieved it. I never expected or wanted to be famous, just an art teacher. and I kept producing. I was one of the original that did that started Gallery 4, and I was in that for 18 years, and it's just part of me. It's just kind of in your blood. You just do it. You can't quit. It's bad. Addictive.
Kim Brumley, you've been teaching at NDSU since 1996, so you've got some marks on your belt as well. I was intrigued when I did a little research about you, because you teach painting at NDSU, you're a professor of art there, that you have been hypnotizing students to assist them with their creativity?
Oh, yes. It's always fun. You know, I took some workshops to learn how to be a hypnotist. When I was teaching down at Kentucky Wesleyan, I taught down there in Kentucky for 9 years before I moved up here, and we had a hypnotist come to the school that did a performance, kind of a stage show, and I was so impressed that I asked him the next year when he came if he could work with my art students. Well, he came, but because he didn't know a lot about art, there was some success, but I thought it could have been better, so I thought, well, I could do this. So I learned how to hypnotize students, and I researched with Jim Council, the late Jim Council, here at NDSU. He was a professor in psychology. So we researched to see if hypnosis would be significant on creativity, and we found that it was. So I used it in my classes. Now, this semester has been a little different because of the COVID, and I'm teaching both online and in class in person at the same time, so it'd be kind of difficult to do now. But, you know, I have them do 3 paintings in class, starting with the baseline painting, and then put them under hypnosis, and the next 2 paintings they do under hypnosis, and each painting is completely different and much more creative at the end.
Boy, I'd love to see this. This is very intriguing. So the FM studio crawl takes place Saturday and Sunday from noon to 6 p.m. That's when you can go to the studios, but you're also going to have an online component this year, Kim, because obviously there's a pandemic, and you and Jackie will be among the handful of artists who will be exclusively online. So give us a sense of how people will find you and what you'll be showing them.
Okay. They have to go to my website, which is kimbobromley.com. And there I've got several different series of works put up, and I have my latest pond paintings. In fact, I've been painting my ponds for several years now, and this year was a little different. I didn't get quite as many paintings done as I would have liked because of the COVID, but I've got some new works, and it's always fun to be out there and be in nature and paint right on location, and I think my paintings show that kind of freshness when you see it. But online, you can go and scroll all the way through all the different images that I've got there.
And if people want to actually discover more information about this event and the artists participating, the website is FMVA for Fargo Moorhead Visual Artists.org. Jackie, how important is this event for participating artists?
Well, let's put it this way. We keep producing, and we can have shows and stuff where we hang a painting, but eventually it collects. And if you get enough under your bed, you want to sell them. And so, you know, it's kind of like if you keep producing it, like I said, it's a disease. So you have that creative spirit and you collect them. Well, you have to dispose of them some way. A few artists make their living at painting. But to me, I don't want to. I just want to keep painting is what it is. Yeah. There's processes in each area that they're with the materials they're working with, and it's definitely you get skilled. As a teacher, though, I had to learn a lot of them, and I'm sure Kim did too, where you have to know a lot of stuff because otherwise your students will kind of eat you alive. You have to be gifted in printmaking and drawing and the sculpture concept of all art if you're an instructor. Interesting, not just being an artist.
We should mention that the studio crawl director is glassblower John Offutt. It's the House of Mulciber. It's a popular stop, typically on the FM studio crawl, because he demonstrates glassblowing techniques. Of course, this year there'll probably be some extra precautions because of the pandemic. But that's interesting to watch, and you'll see a variety of different kinds of art, not just painting, not just sculpture, not just pottery, but all kinds of stuff. And Kim, will the online piece of this be following the same hours, noon to 6, or can you view and buy online anytime?
No, you can do it anytime. You know, the crawl has always been pretty good for me in terms of sales, and so that's kind of a disappointment that I can't be there to talk about the paintings with the people. But anybody that has any questions, they can sure email me or give me a call, and I'd be happy to talk to them about the work.
Now, do most artists have a website where they do some business?
Yes, most of them do. Some don't. I don't, because I'm not savvy tech and I don't find it interesting to spend time doing it. But most of them do. And they sell on Etsy and different sites other than their own websites. Oh, and John is doing blowing outside. He has a mobile unit that he's going to pull outside his studio, so it's not going to be crowded with people. He's adapted that way.
Yes, I have seen the mobile site. I should have thought of that, because that's the perfect solution for him. And of course, this time of year, he makes his gourds sort of their...
Yes.
The fall gourds, and they're very colorful, and they're very accessible in terms of price. And that's important, too.
Yeah.
Because... both of you are, as you mentioned, Jackie, you're selling stuff because if you don't sell it, it collects. And there are some,
I think every artist has that problem in a way. Yeah, we do accumulate things. And then you wonder sometimes, don't others like this so I can get rid of it? I know I did a painting from a scene I had done in Norway. And I thought, oh, I should just get rid of this. Had a nice little bonfire. And I said, oh, I'll throw it in the bin this year. And about 4 years later, this woman came up and she said, oh, I collect these fishing balls. They were green, gold-colored floats. And she said, is this for sale? And I said, sure it is. So I sold it like 4 years later than I painted it. And, you know, you kind of get tired of it growing dusty, but there's always somebody that likes it, someone. Yeah, it's a good feeling when you sell.
I mean, I've got a studio full of paintings. I've got a storage unit full of paintings. I've got a house full of paintings.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Yeah. But when you sell a painting, then you get to buy more paint, is what I always say.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. You got more money for supplies. Otherwise, yeah. It's very expensive. You know, you could get a little bitty 2-inch tube of watercolor paint, and it costs like $20 for the paint. Or yeah. It depends on the pigment in it or the brand. So it's not a giveaway, how can you say, a giveaway for free thing. It does cost the artist to produce these things, their materials.
Kim, you mentioned that the downtown facility for NDSU, that art center that used to be the Northern School Supply,
right,
which has been a center for this crawl, it's not going to be open this time?
No, I don't believe so. Our head of the art department, Michael Strand, he's also the director of the School of Design and Architecture and Art. He's done a whole lot to try to keep the place as safe as possible for students and faculty. And I think, you know, he wants to continue that. So having a lot of other people come through the building wouldn't be productive that way.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it with that. Kim Bromley and Jackie Anderson are members of the Fargo-Moorhead Visual Artists. They'll be participating online for this year's FM Studio Crawl. Find out where and when things are happening at fmva.org. Kim and Jackie, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on Main Street, a Plainsfolk essay from Tom Ezern and Cindy Roholt with a preview of this weekend's North Dakota LGBTQ+ Summit. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's contact tracing facilitator says the state's university system is on a compliance slide when it comes to COVID-19. Vern Dosh says a little more than 30% of North Dakota's student population has been tested. At UND, that figure is more than 40%, according to state health department figures. And Dosh says contact tracing is also a concern statewide.
We are seeing noncompliance almost upwards of 30%, where a positive, when contacted by a contact tracer, will say, sorry, I'm not going to cooperate. I'm not going to tell you who my close contacts were. In some cases, they don't think it's necessary to isolate.
While testing, tracing, and loading the CARE-19 tracing app are all voluntary, Dosh says personal responsibility also comes into play.
The communication of educating the students and making sure they understand the ramifications and the responsibility that they have to volunteer to be tested, to participate with the tracers, it's just such a key aspect of us successfully staying in front of the virus.
As of mid-September, UND led all state campuses with more than 6,500 tests processed. UND also led all campuses with more than 500 total positive cases, but the active case number is currently in double figures. The Grand Forks Council fell one vote short of at least considering a motion requiring a mask mandate similar to one covering the University of North Dakota. Councilmember Brett Weber tried to add the non-agenda item at the end of last night's Committee of the Whole meeting, a move that would have required a unanimous vote of the council. Weber says he was somewhat surprised the issue wasn't included as part of the regularly scheduled meeting.
And it's my understanding that this was brought forward to the mayor and to council president, and so I was anticipating that it was going to be on this evening's agenda.
Weber says the UND student government is on record asking the city to adopt a face covering mandate to slow the spread of COVID-19.
Our student senate passed two resolutions, one asking for a citywide face covering policy consistent with UND, and one reaffirming our support of the city's actions regarding COVID. Students are members of the Grand Forks community, campus and community. We are all Grand Forks.
Councilmember Danny Weigel cast the lone vote against taking up the mask requirement last night. And the state hospital in Jamestown is getting high marks for its safety efforts. Deb Isinger is the quality support services manager at the hospital. She reported that in the period of between July 2019 and June 2020, there were 171 employee safety incidents.
Those were broken down into like falls, trauma, treatment. Of the 171, there was 85 of them related to clients causing the incident. Of those 85, 17 required medical treatment as updated.
Isinger says of the 23 participating state hospitals in the Western Psychiatric State Hospital Association, the state hospital ranked 6th lowest in staff injuries. She says they also did comparatively well with seclusions and restraints. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a scholar of Great Plains history. In his Plainsfolk essays for us, he offers fascinating insights about our part of the world. In today's essay, titled A Handful of Roses, he traces the evolution of a sailor's chanty to a familiar song set on the prairie.
And the cowboys now, as they roam the plain, for they marked the spot where his bones were lain. Fling a handful of roses o'er his grave, with a prayer to him who his soul will save. Recently I sang this stanza in a public performance of the classic cowboy song, The Dying Cowboy, better known as Bury Me Not on the Lone Prairie. It took a while. The standard version of the song, the Lomax text, runs to 13 stanzas plus choruses. That line about flinging roses onto the lonely grave is just one of many exceedingly poetic passages. The song catcher, John Lomax, put The Dying Cowboy first in his 1910 collection, Cowboy Songs and Other Frontier Ballads. That placed it right following the handwritten letter of endorsement from former President Theodore Roosevelt. Lomax was a Texan, but do not conclude from this that The Dying Cowboy is just a Texas song. It is one of those cowboy ballads that ranged up and down the plains. The Jayhawker songcatcher, Myra Hall, found versions in western Kansas. I recently found interesting versions coming out of Montana and North Dakota. And this week surfaced what I think is the earliest known text of The Dying Cowboy, published under the title, The Dying Cowboy Away From Home. In a Tennessee newspaper, the Southern Standard, in 1889. Until I find something earlier, this stands as the prototype for what we know as The Dying Cowboy. Backtrack a little farther, then. I have spoken and written elsewhere about how the song is descended from a poem, The Ocean Buried, by Reverend E. H. Chapin. Published in the Universalist Union in 1839, the stanzas gained currency among seagoing men, sung to a melancholy tune that partakes of dirge and chanty. An unknown adapter then changed the scene from an ocean burial to a prairie interment, and the song entered another oral tradition. The ocean song spoke of sea snakes. The cowboy narrator, recalling his sweetheart back east, intones, "These locks she has curled, will the rattlesnake hiss? This brow she has pressed, will the cold grave kiss? For the sake of her who has wept over me, oh, bury me not on the lone prairie." The cowboy song was circulating before the 1889 publication that I discovered, but that text is quite interesting. It retains much of the oceanic verbiage, with the cowboy dying on a couch, as in a ship cabin. 20 years later, in 1909, reading that Professor Lomax was looking for cowboy ballads, a Mrs. George Reynolds brought her local editor in Culbertson, Montana, a version with some sublime lines, northern references such as, "Where the cold wind sweeps and the grasses wave, no sunbeams rest on a prairie grave." The handful of roses phrase, too, I am convinced, Lomax got from this Culbertson text. Over east, an unknown party in 1910 gave the editor of the Grand Forks Times another fine text, which it appears was the source of additional choice lines in the Lomax compilation. It seems many poets and many preservers were involved in giving us this treasure of a folk song. A handful of roses to every one of them.
That's Tom Ezern. Next on Main Street, the upcoming North Dakota LGBTQ Plus Summit.
Prairie Public is here to help you in the 2020-21 school year. PBS Learning Media has thousands of curated, standards-aligned videos, interactives, lesson plans, and more, easily searchable by grade level and discipline. And it's all free. Find it at prairiepublic.org/education.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. And joining me now is Cindy Roholt. She is a spokesperson for the upcoming third annual North Dakota LGBTQ Plus Conference, which is titled Embrace Your Power Virtual Summit. Cindy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug.
And what is your role with the summit this year?
Well, I'm on the planning committee, and I hold the role of treasurer.
Okay. When did you and the planning committee decide that the summit would have to move online?
Well, you know, we kind of waited until the last minute, really. We had been holding out hope that an October date would be in that magic time. We were thinking in the summer that we would all be able to start gathering together. So we made the decision, I would say, at the end of July.
Where was it last year?
In Mandan.
And how many people turned up?
We had last year about 140 people.
And does this interactivity opportunity, do you think you might have more people because of the accessibility of it?
Well, you'd like to hope that, but we're a little bit down actually. So we've extended our registration through the end of the month. Our original deadline had been the 25th, but we've moved it out a little bit, hoping that we can get a few more people to take advantage of it. You know, you always like to grow, but this year I think we're just doing something a little bit different and people might not be aware.
Who should attend?
You know, really anybody. LGBTQ community, certainly, but allies as well. Anyone who's interested in learning something new and gathering with some folks to see what's going on across the state of North Dakota.
If anybody wants to just search the NDLGBTQ on Google or other search machine, you'll come across the website and the agenda is there. What are the issues on the conference agenda this year?
There's a number of things that are being talked about. It's no surprise that there's a high rate of death by suicide among young LGBTQ plus folks. And so that's something that is really being addressed. The Trevor Project will be here joining us, and they were founded to address exactly that. So we have our Trevor Project advocate, Troy Stevenson, joining us again. They have been with us since the very beginning because it's a very important topic to talk about. So we're going to be having breakout sessions for youth. Also about changing hearts and changing minds around transgender equality, not only in North Dakota, but the United States. Also transgender youth, transgender adults. What happens when you transition in a family? How does that affect the family? We're looking at how the laws that have affected our nation and affect us here in North Dakota, and then equality in general.
Everyone who's under this description, LGBTQ plus, probably has a personal story of that moment when they had to try to open somebody's heart or mind. How is that done?
Well, I think everybody's story is a little bit different. And, you know, probably the most important thing to know about that is it is one's own story. And how you personally make the decision to do that is certainly based on a lot of factors. But how you tell that story too, you get to choose, you know, who you feel safe telling that story to and how much of it you choose to share. I think that coming out stories are a little bit the same. The common thread that I've found is that LGBTQ plus folks feel that they just can't keep hiding anymore, mm-hmm. and they need to be who they are. That's a very, very painful little time or long time there of just not feeling like you're showing the world exactly who you are. I would say that it probably starts with friends, being able to find people that you trust and you know who love you, to be able to tell your truth to, and hopefully your family. In some cases, maybe not hopefully your family, depending on how accepting they are.
Is there a good estimate of the number of North Dakotans who identify as LGBTQ?
Nationwide, the percentage has been stated for years as 10%. That's probably a pretty good percentage to go by. Might be a little bit higher.
So that would be about 75,000 people in North Dakota.
That's right.
How friendly is North Dakota to its LGBTQ residents?
You know, Doug, it really depends on where you are living. I think that it's a lot easier to feel more isolated the more rural you are in North Dakota. And, you know, we both know that there is a lot of rural North Dakota. So when you're in a place that has more population, chances of you having more acceptance is higher. So in Fargo, you know, as you come farther east in the state, I would say that there is more acceptance. But certainly Bismarck, Minot, Williston all have established communities of LGBTQ folks. So it's not like there are places where it doesn't exist in North Dakota.
Well, it exists in politics, that's for sure. It can be a national political issue. It can certainly turn up in the legislature. It has on numerous occasions. So let's talk about LGBTQ politics and being used as a political football. What are the political issues that are most pressing for this population?
Well, certainly in the political climate that we're in, being able to maintain the strides that have been made thus far, not having to worry about whether our marriages are legal, whether our children are legal, whether we have the ability to stay in our homes without being evicted, to be able to stay in our jobs without being fired. Those are all areas where there has been great progress in recognizing the equality of LGBTQ North Dakotans and Americans. But it's also something that feels once again like it's some of it might be on a little bit shaky ground politically, or at least people would like you to think so.
Uh-huh. Well, in your lifetime, how have things changed since you came out?
Oh, gosh. Well,
you mentioned a couple of them, I think.
Yeah, a couple of them for sure. I've gotten married, and that has been greatly satisfying and just fulfilling in knowing that I have a relationship that I can share in a way that I may not have been able to at another point in time. I mean, this is all really fairly recent, and there are many folks that are still not married because they are still concerned that their family might not accept them. I went to a wonderful wedding this weekend of a couple of friends who are in their 70s, and it was just delightful, you know, to know that sometimes people wait until they find the right person, and it's just like any other marriage, Doug.
Well, I know that Skip Wood, the producer of this show, has worked with the Red River Rainbow Seniors to create this oral history of those experiences that they went through, because these are older LGBTQ plus people that probably spent the majority of their lives moving quietly around, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that exists. And there are other initiatives that there are plays, there are movies, there are popular mm-hmm. novels, and a lot of popular culture now revolves around issues that relate to this. One would have hope that the world is opening up, or at least the United States and North Dakota are opening up to the spectrum of sexual life as opposed to the niche.
We've got a couple of keynote speakers that will be directing their discussion exactly to what's going on in North Dakota legally and legislatively. Joshua Boucher will be there again. We also have Erica Thunder speaking on Sunday. So the summit is really about the state coming together to hear what's going on and to, of course, have community, but also be able to hear what is what's going on in the state. We've got a couple people that are speaking to family law and to, you know, of course, the health issues, which I mentioned before. But also we're having breakout sessions about what's going on with the military. I mean, that's obviously something that has changed over time as well. The website address is ndlgbtqsummit.com.
And when you go there, the agenda is there. There's a way to register, and the cost of the summit ranges from $30 for students to $70 for adults. There's some breaks in between those two. And you're expecting that some of your participants will be under the age of 18, right?
Yep, we've got some special breakouts for them as well.
So how do you do the breakouts when you've got a summit where you don't have actual conference rooms? And so these are virtual breakouts. How do you do it?
Well, I think we're all more familiar with Zoom than we ever thought we would be when we first heard the word.
Yeah.
In back in March, teaching went online, so we all had a crash course in, or not all of us, obviously, but you know, many of us had a crash course in Zoom, and over the course of the last 6 months, have attended different kinds of meetings, connected with people, you know, literally all over the world in talking about different topics. And we're going to be doing exactly the same thing here.
Well, I noted that when I checked the agenda, there was lunch and there was there's kind of this interactivity opportunity. I think it was, what are you eating?
That's right.
So I assume that people will be able to go back and forth then.
Well, absolutely. You know, one of the nice things about the summit is that you can register for the summit and kind of pick and choose what you want to go to. You can go away for a while. You can come back to hear a keynote speaker that you're particularly interested in or a topic that you're particularly interested in. But there'll also be that, you know, that feeling of community coming together, although it will be in little boxes on a screen. For breakfast, for lunch, and with icebreakers that we're doing throughout the summit, where we get an opportunity to talk and find out what, you know, maybe what the group in Williston is doing or what the group in Minot is doing, and just pull together all of those great warm feelings that we have when we come together.
Besides registration fees, how is the summit funded?
Oh, we've got wonderful partnership of actually three national groups. The National Center for Lesbian Rights is with us again this year. Ming Wong will be joining us. He has worked with the National Center for Lesbian Rights for quite a long time. As I said, Troy Stevenson with the Trevor Project will be with us. We've also had assistance from the Equality Federation. So North Dakota has gotten some attention for a number of things, some of them good, some of them not so good, but being able to have national groups to help guide us and to help fill us in on what's going in the nation has been great. We also have local people that have helped us across the state as well. North Dakota Human Rights Coalition was an organization that helped us get our start. Alpha Steed is a new organization that has been a financial backer for us this year. Magic City Equality in Minot is an LGBTQ plus organization there. Red River Rainbow Seniors, North Dakota Two-Spirit Society and Allies, AARP North Dakota, Dakota Outright, and On-Call Chaplains in the state of North Dakota, as well as some individual sponsors.
So lots of support. It's coming up this weekend, and you can watch it online from the comfort of wherever you want to be. It's the Embrace Your Power Virtual Summit, the third annual North Dakota LGBTQ plus conference. And find out more by going where, Cindy?
You can go to ndlgbtqsummit.com. And registration has been extended through the end of September.
Cindy Roholt is a planner for the upcoming conference. Thanks, Cindy.
Thanks, Doug. Good talking to you.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Listen to NPR News at work, even if you're working in your slippers. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR and stay connected at home.
You've got not one, but two streams of Prairie Public to choose from on your smart speaker. Just ask it and listen.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 29th. Helen Virginia Briggs was born on this date in 1910 and grew up in Fargo. Her father was an insurance broker and her mother an exceptional golfer who won the state golf championship three times. Helen preferred her middle name, Virginia. She was a petite blue-eyed blonde who was active in all facets of life at Fargo Central High. After she graduated in 1929, the family moved to California. Virginia was soon discovered while touring the Paramount movie studio. Harry Wurtzel, publicist for director William Bodine, offered her a personal contract of $25 a week. Virginia changed her last name to Bruce, and over the next year, she played small roles in 19 films. Ironically, one of Virginia's bigger breaks came while working with several other North Dakotans on the 1930 musical Whoopee. The director was Thornton Freeland of Hope, North Dakota, and one of her co-stars was Ann Southern of Valley City. Virginia caught the interest of a set designer who helped her land a role in a Ziegfeld comedy starring Fred Astaire. Working in New York, her wages went up to $50 a week. But after performing in another Ziegfeld film, she headed back to Hollywood, where she landed the lead female role in Downstairs, a 1932 movie written by leading man and heartthrob John Gilbert. Gilbert had made his mark in the age of silent films, but when talkies came along, he didn't have the voice to carry him forward. Gilbert hoped Downstairs would save his career, but it didn't work out. He did, however, fall in love with his leading lady, Virginia Bruce, and they were married. They had a daughter in 1933, but Gilbert's fall from fame haunted the marriage, which lasted only one more year. Virginia went on to become one of the top actresses of her time, starring with men such as Jimmy Stewart, Robert Taylor, Frederick March, John Barrymore, and James Cagney. As the 1929 Paramount Pictures bio stated, she was a dainty beauty with that certain something called it. In 1937, Virginia married J. Walter Reuben, the director-producer of The Bad Man of Brimstone, in which she played the lead. But he died less than 5 years later of heart disease. In 1946, she married Ali Ipar, a Turkish writer-producer. And in 1953, she became the first American actress to star in a Turkish film, The Plague. Virginia Bruce died in Los Angeles on February 24, 1982. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Mary Helm, I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The New Orleans band Tank and the Bangas have strong feelings about a divided America and how it feels like we have been here before.
Everybody know what tradition is. It's something that's passed down from generations in your family. And that's what I feel like hate is.
They share their entry for the Morning Edition Song Project. Plus, we'll recap the first presidential debate on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and you can always find Main Street at prairiepublic.org as an archived podcast after the broadcast. Tomorrow on our show, we'll discuss education issues with Brant Dick, who's running for superintendent of the Department of Public Instruction. And the Empire Theater Company is going digital for its latest production, making a stage performance available statewide. We'll get the details from production manager Maddie Sharp. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.